organization, and I think that if you get the opportunity and you want to help somebody out, because this is a nonprofit organization and these men and women are traveling all over the world trying to help people out, you can go to teamrubicon.org. It's teamrubicon.org, R-U-B-I-C-O-N. And maybe you can help them out. And it said if you need help anytime for a national disaster or a natural disaster for any type, he said just go to their website and send them an email and they'll get in touch with you and see if they can help you out. So that's Team Rubicon. We're going to be back in just a moment with our guest, Major General Patrick Henry Brady, Medal of Honor recipient for his duties in Vietnam. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we are back on Veterans Radio, and we're welcoming our guest today, Major General Pat Brady, who has served over 34 years in the Army and duty stations around the world, in Berlin at the building of the wall, as a commander on the DMZ in Korea and the Dominican Republic, in the Pentagon as a chief spokesman for the Army, and two tours in Vietnam. And during his two tours as a dust-off pilot, he rescued over 5,000 wounded. I think the number is probably higher. Flew over 2,500 combat missions, and he has won both the Medal of Honor and the Distinguished Service Cross, only one of two Vietnam soldiers to do that. His awards are too lengthy to list, but just an incredible man, and I'm very excited to have him on the program today. If you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call at 877-573-7825, and welcome to Veterans Radio, General Brady.
Good to be with you.
It's a pleasure, sir, and I want to tell you, your book, Dead Men Flying, was really a time trip for me and probably for a lot of pilots who read it. I love the story, and I love what you did over there. Thank you so much for your service.
Were you a pilot in Vietnam?
Yes, sir. I was one of those Wally Warrant guys. I flew with the 195th Assault Helicopter Company in 3 Corps. We were the Sky Chiefs, and
what year were you there?
I was there in 1969.
Okay, you were a little after me. I worked the three corps area early 64-65 time frame.
Right, you're flying around in your B model Hueys.
Yes, indeed. I loved the B model. We did a lot of night work. The B model, of course, the H model, which we used later on, carried a lot more patience. But the B model was so flat and handy for night work. You could make an approach really flat, and I loved the B model the way it performed at night.
I'm gonna try to, every time we come up with an acronym here for our audience, I'll try to correct and fill in the blanks for all of the spaces that we may leave out when we start talking about helicopters. But my wife said, "What are you doing over there?" I was reading the book, and my hands and my feet were moving as I'm reading some of the rescues that they did, which I think is what every helicopter pilot seems to do. We can't tell a story without moving the controls.
Yeah, that's for sure. The fighter pilots don't like to be around us because, you know, they count their missions in the 100. We counted ours in the thousands. And the other thing about it was that I teased my fighter pilot friends about the fact that they're not really pilots. They don't fly. They ride. Your only real pilots are helicopter pilots because it takes both hands, both feet. And probably when you and I started to fly, it took a wrist, too, a motorcycle grip to keep that sucker in the air.
That's true, because I also trained in the Hiller H-23.
Hiller the Killer, they called it.
Yes, down at Fort Walters, Texas. and it was quite the adventure. I can tell you that. My story to fighter pilots is, you know, I said, you know, it's amazing that you guys can go, you know, 800 miles an hour, but I said, how fast can you go backwards?
Yes, that's right.
And sideways and stop.
Yeah. And how many times do they land? And yeah. where do they land?
In our case, and in your case especially, anywhere you wanted.
I think. That's true, and most often on the battlefield.
I think so. We're talking with Major General Patrick Brady, a Medal of Honor recipient, about his book, Dead Men Flying. And I guess I'd like to kind of go through this chronologically with you, sir, if we can. You mentioned that in your book, you were not the image of the perfect officer in the military, were you? You had some issues.
No, it's very, very true. When I came out of high school in the 50s, I had an opportunity to go play football, and I had this little girlfriend, and she was going to a university that didn't have a football team, but it did have ROTC. And so I thought I better keep an eye on her, and so I followed her, gave up the scholarships, and ended up ROTC being mandatory for me. Well, I had a bad attitude about it. And by the way, I married that gal. I got even with her. Still after 55 years. So, but in any event, I had to go into ROTC. I had no choice. And by the time I got out of college, I was married and had a couple children. And so I figured, well, they actually threw me out after 2 years, which was the first 2 years is mandatory, but they had a new cadre when I came back, and they took me back, and I got commissioned. But my thing was just to serve my time and get out, because I did not like the uniform. I didn't like saluting, and I couldn't march very well. So I was not your ideal soldier. But in any event... But in any event, when I went to Berlin, my first assignment, I met some incredible people. My commander later became Chief of Staff of the Army. Norm Schwarzkopf was there, and some other great soldiers. And I just thought, gee whiz, it'd be nice if I could grow up and be like them. And so I was a mess as far as a soldier goes. I just wasn't suited to it initially. And so my record showed it. And I had some great difficulties, you know, getting along and doing the discipline things, but the military taught me discipline, and thank God I had the military. There's no telling what would happen to me otherwise.
Well, I think there are many, many of us that can relate to that. You know, it was there when we needed it to be there, I think.
You bet.
And so you really did kind of live through history, and I was fascinated because you were in Berlin, you said, when the wall went up.
Yes. Yeah. That was my first experience with communism. You know, I'm a young idealistic guy coming out of college, and I'd read of Mao Zedong and the Long March and thought, you know, this is a pretty tough guy, and Russia was into space, and they had their system, and I just didn't know. And then all of a sudden we wake up August 13th, 61, I think it was, and they divided the city. As you know, or many people may not know, the city was 110 miles behind the Iron Curtain, and it was occupied by the four forces. And I didn't, you know, all of a sudden they're shooting their own people off the wall. I was a medical platoon leader, and we were picking up the mess. I thought, what in the heck is going on here? These people are killing their own people. And we had, believe it or not, as a second lieutenant in Berlin, I had a maid and a babysitter. And my babysitter was engaged, her fiancé was in the east across Checkpoint Charlie in East Germany, East Berlin. She never saw him again.
Oh, my.
And our maid, her mother and father, when they died in the east, she could not go to their funeral. So that was my first experience. And then, of course, I saw the real horrors of communism in Vietnam, and also in Korea when I was working in the DMZ. So it was it's a horrible, horrible, evil system. And, of course, that's why we went to Vietnam. Very simple thing there, just to help the helpless people be free of the evils of communism and show them the fruits of freedom. And the GI did a great job, and that's part of what the book's about, the humanitarian effort over there.
Right. So I did want to get into that in a little bit. If you want to have a question for General Brady, give us a call here at 877-573-7825. How did you end up going to flight school?
Well, my father was with Darby's Rangers in World War II, and so when I went in, I says, well, I got to be a Ranger, and then I want to be airborne, and then I want to go to flight school. And the reason, the motivation was always because I make more money doing that.
That's true.
So I applied initially when I was in basic officers training, and I got a response when I got to Berlin saying, whoops, you're in Berlin, we can't send you to flight school. So when I came out of Berlin, I applied once again, and they took me this time. And I trained at Fort Walters and volunteered for Vietnam because you got more money over there, and besides, it was the only place where there was any action.
Well, that is true. And you turned out to be what I used to call was an RLO, which was a real live officer. And you had a different name, and I'm trying to find it in here. I on my list of what you called them.
It was an RFO, and your listeners can figure that out.
Right, yeah, we don't need to do that. we run into that word quite often as we read through, although it's all kinds of symbols there.
Yes.
So that was going on there. So you went to Vietnam for the first time in 1964, did you say?
Yes, and
go ahead.
That I got there when Charles Kelly was one of the great heroes I've ever known, and he was a veteran of World War II. He'd been severely wounded in World War II and came out at the time the only living veteran with all the four of the medals, you know, flight wings, jump wings. And he also had a combat infantry badge and a combat medical badge. Mm-hmm. And he got there to Vietnam. We really didn't know how to use the resource, and neither did the leadership. You've got this expensive machine and four lives, and you got combat going on. And the idea initially was just to protect the Americans. We only had 16,000 Americans in Vietnam when I got there. And so they just didn't know how to use that resource, and it wasn't flying a lot. So the leadership decided to take it away from Kelly and put a portable Red Cross on it. Well, Kelly says, you're not going to do that. That's insane. And a guy named Stillwell, the son of Vinegar Joe, was his great adversary in that thing. So Kelly came back and he said, listen, guys, they don't wish us well. For the first time since the Civil War, they're going to confiscate a medical resource. We have to prove to them that we can do better than they can do, do what we do better than they can do. And so he went about to prove it. And we did our best to keep up with him. Flying night, we were the only unit that flew at night. And to fly onto the battlefield during the battle, nobody else did that. And so he set incredible records for patient carrying. And when he would land in a village, the entire village would turn out, and they would see, here's the Americans taking this valuable machine, four lives, risking them for a peasant and a rice paddy. And it made a great impression on the people. So, as I tell in the book, the battle went on to take the aircraft away from us, and I don't think it was settled. I know it wasn't settled until Kelly was killed. Mm-hmm. And he was killed during a pickup once again on the battlefield under fire, and the people on the ground screamed at him to get out. And his dying words were, when I have your wounded. He would not leave until he had the wounded, and after he said that, he took a bullet right through the heart. Okay. And folded up the aircraft, died on the spot, and Westmoreland had come in by then. And they tell me that Stillwell broke down and cried when he heard that Kelly was dead. But in any event, that ended it. And to this day, his dying words are the standard for dust-off aeromedical evacuation across the world. And he set the example for all of us from that moment on, and nobody ever tried, until recently, by the way. That's another issue. They've done the same thing they did to Kelly, which is insane, but that's what's going on today.
Yeah, I want to get into that later on in our interview when we talk about what's going on today. But I think all pilots had heard it of Kelly through flight school. He was one of those people that was held up as an example that, you know, this is what a pilot's supposed to do. This is, you know, our mission. I mean, we did a lot of ash and trash. We did some other stuff, you know, working with some special forces units. But we always felt that it was our obligation to help people. And I was not a medevac pilot or a dust-off pilot. And as I was reading your book, I was going, oh, my God, I should have waited for those guys to show up sometimes. But we would go in and help people. It didn't make any difference what side they were on. And I don't think that the American public knew that we were doing that.
No, that's one of the great victories in Vietnam. The humanitarian effort over there. For the first time, I think, in history, up to this point in time in history anyhow, the humanitarian, in the midst of its heroic actions, the GI also had time for a humanitarian effort. Usually we go in, we blow things up, we kill people, civilians or whoever else is in our way. In Vietnam, we didn't do that. During the battle, we fixed and we vaccinated and we built hospitals and orphanages and adopted those children. Dust-Off rescued some 900,000 patients, men, women, children, enemy as well as friendly. We carried them all, even scout dogs, when they got hurt. So it was a great humanitarian effort, and that was the purpose, you know, win the hearts and minds and show the people the difference between the evils. And by the way, you know, when I go back, and I've been back about three times, the people there really treat me great. And the kids on the street, especially in Saigon or Ho Chi Minh City, when I talk to them about America, the place they want to go more than anywhere else is America. So we left a great impression on them. I think they love America to this day. And I attribute that to the GI, because those people who were children then are grown up now, and they've taught their children about how caring the American GI was when he was there trying to protect them from communism. And I think communism is essentially dead. They just don't know what to do with the corpse.
That's true.
They tried it. You know, they tried their confiscating property and education camps and all that, and it was a disaster. And so they had to retreat from it, the same as Lenin did in Russia. And so now you see enterprise, you see property ownership, you see an industrious, wonderful people, hardworking, wonderful people the Vietnamese are, and they're doing very well economically. I wish our growth was like theirs.
Well, I know. I have a number of Vietnamese students, actually, in the community college where I teach, and they always talk about how much they appreciate what we have done to help them out, and especially coming here. And they said, you know, it's pretty much all true what they heard. And I like it when they say that. So let's go back to Vietnam, 1964-65. As you mentioned, there were only about 16,000 American troops there at the time. And your area of operation was everywhere, wasn't it?
Yes, we covered the entire country then with five helicopters. We had them located in Saigon and two down at Sok Trang. And initially when I got there, we had one up at Pleiku and Quy Nhon, covering the North Country. And Kelly consolidated the two from the North in Sok Trang, because that's where the action was. That's where the casualties were. Mm-hmm. And he went down there and took what we call Detachment A. He promised me, because his headquarters was in Saigon. That's where he should have been. But there was not as much flying there, and he wanted to be where the flying was. And you would appreciate this, I think, as a helicopter pilot. His last month, June, before he was killed, he flew 149 hours. Huh. And the limit on, I don't know how much you slick guys flew, but I think you probably flew more than we did. But the limit was like 90 hours, and they tried to stop him. They said, you can't fly that much, just against the regulations. And he said, what do you want me to do, leave the guys in the field? So they didn't mess with him.
They limited us, I believe it was to 120 hours in a 30-day time period. And, you know, they'd sit you down for a day, and then you'd go back up and start over again, it seemed.
Is that the way it worked?
I think so. That was kind of a rolling 30-day average is what they were trying to tell
you. Yeah, well, I thought it was 90 hours and 30 days, but or in 90 hours and 30 days, and it came from the Air Force. It made no sense.
That's true. It's fascinating when you were telling about that earlier, about the number of landings and takeoffs and things that go on. And obviously, we don't want to offend any other Air Force or other types of pilots. But, you think about how many times you landed in just one day. And how many missions that you would go on. And I didn't keep track like you did, but I can imagine. I know, we would fly six or seven different types of missions every day.
Yeah, hey, by the way, I don't mind offending the Air Force guys. It doesn't bother me a bit.
You can say that. I still have to get them on the program as guests every once in a while,
No, they're my friends, but it's all in good humor. But, yes, they, in fact, I don't. We came up with the number of missions when we left it. That's 30, 40 years ago. And so recently a guy went back through my flight records, and I made, while I was in Vietnam, 2 years, over 4,000 landings.
Wow.
And one day, I think 45 or so landings. That's landings, and it's, some of them are at the hospital, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them are in the field, confined areas, jungles, mountains, and stuff like that. So the landings, that's what separates. To me, that's the thing. When you have to land in a confined area on a pinnacle or at night in weather or in fog, that takes a lot of, it's very challenging.
It brings your anxiety level up sometimes.
Yes.
I was thinking about that segment in your book this morning because it's very foggy here today. And as we were coming into the parking lot for the studio, and I'm going, I wonder what he would do here.
next time you do that, just roll down your window.
I know.
And look out the side window and see how much further you can see as opposed to the windshield.
I adopted your procedures without even knowing it when I was in country, when we would run into fog and stuff. You just kind of kick it out of trim a little bit and look out the window, and you can see you can see quite a ways. It was really quite surprising.
Better.
And keeping the I'm giving the secrets away. Anyway. Tell me about when you were in Vietnam the first time. Could you kind of describe to our audience, we've got about 3 minutes before we're going to take a break, what a typical mission would be and how it operated at that time?
Well, in the early, we got better, as I said, later on. Mm-hmm. Initially, in the early days, you get a call. Most often it would come through a Vietnamese operations center direct to us at the flight line. And we would run to the aircraft. Later, when we set standards, my second tour standard was 2 minutes to get off the ground. Mm-hmm. And then we'd head out. Very often in the early days, we had no radio contact with an English-speaking person. So we had a set of coordinates, heading and distance, and we knew the terrain. And so we would, when we get there, they initially tried to say, we'll say Alpha Bravo, and you say Charlie Delta, and then you know it's friendly. Mm-hmm. But that never worked. And so what we would do then is very often make a low pass to see if they were friendly or if we got shot at. And if they looked friendly and it looked good, then we would land. But we had very often we had no radio contact. And the other thing, I learned to speak just one mouthful of Vietnamese. I could say Cha Dia Chi Kua Ong, which means pop smoke or show me your signal or show me your address.
Mm-hmm.
But the smoke could be problematic because if we said, if they would pop smoke and they would say, yellow smoke is out, you would look down there and you see two or three yellow smoke.
Right, the bad guys would throw out yellow smoke. Yes.
The bad guy would throw it out. So after a few bad experiences with that, we said, all right, you pop your smoke and I'll identify the color and when we could talk to them. So, but in any event, that was typical. We learned how to make tactical approaches, trial and error, and we can talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go get the patients, and we would take them right to either a Vietnamese or the Navy hospital in Saigon. At that time, we didn't have a lot of Army medical or other hospitals, surgical hospitals, field hospitals. In the early days, we had mostly Vietnamese hospitals. Mm-hmm. And in the highlands up in the north, they wouldn't take mountain yards. The first load of mountain yard patients I took into a Vietnamese hospital, they left them on the ramp. I could not believe it. kind of like the blacks in America in the early days. But then we had Doc Smith up there, and she, an American, great American, who founded a Mountain Yard Hospital up there, and her story is in the book, and she was a great person.
There are some amazing stories in this book. Well, we're talking with Major General Patrick Brady about his experiences as a dust-off pilot in Vietnam, Medal of Honor recipient. And we're going to be taking a break here in just a second, so I'm going to ask you to hold on. If you want to give in on the conversation or ask the general a question, you can give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. When we come back at the bottom of the hour here, we're going to be talking with General Brady about his second tour in Vietnam, the Tet Offensive, and some other things. And we're going to get into some tactic, because I think that will be fun to talk about, because I want to talk about some of the tactics that we adopted when I was there that we tried to bring back to our students. So you're listening to Veterans Radio, and we'll be right back after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Major Patrick Brady rescued 51 men in one day. Details after this. Brady was flying medevac helicopters on his second tour in Vietnam when he volunteered to rescue two badly wounded South Vietnamese soldiers in enemy territory. When he arrived, the site was shrouded in fog. He descended slowly until he saw the tops of trees and then moved sideways to the landing site. Despite heavy enemy fire, he was able to locate the soldiers and evacuated them. Brady was called to another fogged-in area where American casualties lay close to enemy lines. He lowered his chopper through the fog and found a stream bed that led to the wounded. In all, he made five flights to rescue 39 GIs. On his third mission, the controls on his chopper were hit, but he managed to get home. He got a replacement chopper and returned. On his fourth mission, Brady watched a mine explode near the landing site, forcing another medevac to leave. Brady went in and set his chopper in the skid marks of the other craft. Two crew members were carrying a stretcher to the chopper when one stepped on a mine. The explosion blew a hole in Brady's craft. He managed to get it off the ground and delivered the six severely wounded men to the aid station. He picked up another helicopter and kept flying. In all, he evacuated 51 men that day. 400 bullet holes were counted in the helicopters he flew that day. Brady went on to become a major general in the United States Army. He was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Nixon on October 9th, 1969. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. You'll have to excuse me for doing a little time tripping with that particular song. I was trying to find our guest today is Major General Patrick Brady, a Medal of Honor recipient, and I know that you like Up, Up, and Away by the Fifth Dimension, but I couldn't find it this morning, so I thought I'd get a little Ghost Riders in the Sky. For all the Ghost Riders out there that were in Vietnam in the late 60s, early 70s, that song was dedicated to you today.
Well, there's a chapter in the book about what we call Ghost Riders, I think, in my book, where something was chasing us one night, and we never had figured out what it was.
Yeah, you did say that. We were stationed at Long Bend every once in a while, and we would go to the, when we were allowed to go to the officers' club there, because everybody was so, you know, in starch fatigues and everything, they couldn't understand pilots to begin with. And we would always ask the Filipino band to play Ghost Riders, and we would stand up, you know, and shout it out, let's put it that way. So you survived your first tour, and you came back, and so what happened when you got back to the States?
Well, I went to Fort Benning, and we flew in support of the Ranger training camp down in Florida, and also the airborne school at Fort Benning. We're flying H-19s, which was really a beast. Have you ever flown an H-19?
No, I've just seen them shoot themselves apart.
Oh yeah. Oh Lord, they are. But it actually improved my flying skills, because it's difficult to get off the ground, and we flew single pilot in those days, so you had to fly, you had to navigate, you had to handle the fuel, you had to do everything, and the patient was downstairs from you, kind of. So that did, I think, improve my skills, and then all of a sudden we got word they were going back to Vietnam, and they took out everybody out of the unit but me and two other guys. And so, and all the pilots who were going back with us the second tour had graduated in flight school in the same day. And of course, by then, Dustoff had a good reputation, and these guys, thought they were handpicked to fly Dustoff. These were the warrant officers.
Mm-hmm.
And, all their names started with an S. So they had taken this, this class and they gave them to me. And so I got all these wobbly ones, and I've got to get them ready to go into combat in a very short period of time. And I think I had like 22 hours to, but I did the best I could, and then we went to Vietnam. And by this time, there were 500,000 Americans mm-hmm. in Vietnam. First tour, we carried 4,000 patients the whole year. Second tour, we're carrying almost that many in a month. So, they were... Charles Kelly, I think, was 149th American killed. You know, they were killing that many in a week or more. So that was the second tour, and we had all these. And, of course, we went into a mountainous area where weather and terrain were very difficult. More of our pilots were being killed, and I'm sure the same is true of your units, were killed at night and in weather than were killed by the enemy.
Yes, and, especially the ones up north.
Yes, and so I was scared to death. I'm a hardcore Irish Catholic guy, and my faith is so important. I was praying like crazy to find ways to get the patients out at night in weather, low valley fog in the daytime, and keep these young warrant officers who I knew would do anything in their power to go get the patients to keep them from killing themselves. So we found some techniques to do that, and turned out to be an extraordinary unit, and that was the reason I wrote the book, because of the numbers associated with that unit, my second tour.
They really are astronomical as far as the number of patients that you call them, that you were able to save. And we talk about in the book, and I'll let you talk about it, the amount of combat that these infantrymen were in Vietnam. And we always admire all of the other service members from World War I, World War II, of course, but these guys were constantly exposed to it, much like the troops are in Afghanistan today.
Yes, I don't know that we've ever fought any war where the combat was as intense as it was for the grunts in Vietnam. The average guy in World War II in 4 years was in combat about 40 days. The average guy in Vietnam in 1 year was in combat about 240 days.
Mm-hmm.
He was, and, you know, we had such great empathy for those guys. They were down there in the mud and the blood, and they had these incredible loads that they had to carry, and so we were going to do everything in our power to help them, because I don't know that there's ever been a soldier anywhere who had any worse. It was very hot, and everything there bit you or stung you and or sucked your blood. And so they're out in the middle of that stuff, and, we flew home at night to an airfield, and we had sheets on our beds. I think we had sheets, but in any event, we were sleeping in a bed, and they were sleeping in the mud. So, yes, those guys had it as hard, and the way they were treated when they came home was just horrible.
I totally agree with you, and at the time, I didn't realize how much I should have admired them then as much as I do today. For what they had to go through on a daily basis, and as you say, we flew in, flew out, and went to bed in a bed.
And yes,
with relatively normal food. I kind of exaggerate that, but they lived on whatever they could find out there in the jungles, with not only the creatures of the insect variety, but they also ran into animals. You had a story, and we've talked to another gentleman on the program who talked about tigers up north.
Yeah.
And you had Eaton in action, where they had lost somebody. I think it was the book was The Matterhorn, and he had talked about losing somebody to a tiger.
Yeah, they that's true. You got the WIA, wounded in action, KIA, killed in action, EIA, eaten in action, and that may have been with tongue-in-cheek a bit, but that happened while I was at Pleiku, where a tiger fell into a foxhole with a guy and ate him, or mostly ate him, before they could get to him. So, yes, it was dangerous. what those guys were doing, not only because of the enemy, who was very, very proficient in the jungle and in that kind of warfare, but because of all the stuff around them. And when we went to play coup, they still had plague patients. So you got these, we would drop these medics out in the villages, surrounded by the enemy, dental technicians, dentists to take care of the peasants and the Vietnamese people. They could do so much in such a short period of time, but they're exposed to, you know, if you get bit by a flea or something, you got the plague and there's leprosy. They told us that it wasn't communicable, but, you know, that's hard. That's hard to believe. Somehow they got that. But anyhow, they had some exotic diseases over there, not to mention hepatitis and those other things. Yes. So the guy was exposed.
Yes, and your malaria and your...
Yeah, malaria. That was...
those wonderful pills.
Yeah.
On a daily basis. Could you describe your crew? What made up a crew on a dust-off aircraft?
The crew was a pilot, a co-pilot, an aircraft commander. One of the pilots was the aircraft commander. He was in charge of the mission. Mm-hmm. And then in the back you had the medic, a very, very highly trained, maybe not initially, but became very experienced in traumatic injuries. In other words, treating amputees, gunshot wounds, sucking chest wounds, belly wounds, stuff like that. He became very good at that. And then you had the crew chief. He owned the aircraft. It was his job to maintain the aircraft. And these were the highest quality soldiers I've ever been around. And we had a NCO, Sergeant Hodgson. A building is named after him down at Fort Rucker, mm-hmm. who was an absolute genius when it came to maintenance. And he kept us in the air. We had an aircraft shot up about every 4 or 5 days. And we flew night and day, about 4 missions a night. And the workload, you're looking at a 40-man detachment. That's 40 men. Mm-hmm. You're looking at 6 aircraft that we covered a monstrous area, and only 3 of them would be flyable at any one time because they were getting shot up in maintenance problems. And among those 40 men, 26 Purple Hearts. That's how many were shot. Some of them were more than once. But none of them were killed, thank God. That changes the nature of the unit. And in a 9.5-month period, we carried 21,000 patients. That's more than were carried during the entire Korean War. And by the way, 3 of those 40 men are in the Aviation Hall of Fame, and 5 of them are in the Dust-Off Hall of Fame, something probably no other unit can come close to.
Can I ask you one question? Were dust-off ships armed?
Some weren't. In other words, the first cab, which was not dust-off, they went by medevac. Mm-hmm. They were direct support. We were an area support resource. I didn't like the guns. I never liked them. You can't hit what you're shooting at. There's friendlies down there. You never see the enemy. It's stupid. But some people, they liked it. And the first cab actually had the crew chief and the gunner on the aircraft, which took up space and didn't do any good. It just didn't do any good. So I was against it. You were authorized, of course, to have weapons to protect yourself and your patients. There's nothing contrary to Geneva Conventions as far as that goes, but I was one who liked the quiet approach. If you got fire, you knew that it was from the enemy. And it's hard to teach a guy to shoot out of a helicopter because you actually shoot behind the target. Right. And we tried to teach our door gunners, our guys, because the crew chief and the medic are the gunners when you come into an area. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want them shooting.
I understand that. We got to take a quick break here, General, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Give us a call, 877-573-7825. We'll be right back. And we're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking with Major General Patrick Brady, Medal of Honor recipient during the Vietnam conflict as a dust-off pilot, and with hundreds and thousands of missions and saved many, many lives. And I mentioned earlier, General, that many of the techniques that I read about in your book were things that we were taught once I got in country, not necessarily in flight school, but once we got in country of, you know, the high overhead approaches and low-level approaches and kick turns into LZs and resting skids on the side of mountains. And when I came back, they made me an instructor down at Fort Rucker, and we tried to show our students in that and got in all kinds of trouble.
Yeah, much of it is against the rules,
I know.
Actually.
I know.
And so the two, you know, the two awards, the Medal of Honor and the Distinguished Service Cross, which I have, were a result of two epiphanies that I had over there. And as I say, I'm a guy who wears my faith on my sleeve. And I'm really worried the second tour, because we have great challenges in terms of weather.
Right.
Now, the first tour I managed a low level fast approach, and the overhead, what they call the death spiral.
Mm-hmm.
Those were kind of routine, and the terrain dictated how you get into it. But you can't use those approaches in weather, especially in the low valley fog and the night tropical storms.
Yes.
So the first technique was a night weather mission. We got a call, a place called Death Valley. You're flat terrain on the coast, and you got to go over a mountain range to get into the valley and get the patients out. And it was in the middle of a tropical storm, and the aircraft were grounded. And I headed out, and I thought I could use techniques from my first tour, which is, you know, you got a guy lays on the floor, watches for a light behind you, and you watch for a light in front of you, and then you go only as far as you've got a light. Well, you know, we just ran into ink. Mm. But then I had my first epiphany, which I remembered an earlier mission when I was in the valley, sitting on a mountaintop. And you know how beautiful that can be at night when the tracers are going off and the flares are falling, and it really is pretty.
Yeah, it
is. So,
like 4th of July.
Yeah, but I looked up and I saw a mountaintop, and I noticed that it was in the clouds, but the flares silhouetted it. So then I knew how I was going to get those patients out. I went into the weather, flew IFR to the pickup site, and then I followed the flares down through the mountains and made four flights that night and got all the patients out. So that solved the night weather problem. You have to go IFR to the site, and then you let down VFR, which is visual flight rules, for those who don't fly. And then that solved it. So we never left a patient in the field at night and weather. The day weather problems were probably the reason I got the Medal of Honor, because that day was a couple of the missions got a lot of visibility because the people were on a mountaintop watching me come up out of the fog.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a call one afternoon for a kid who was on a mountain who had been bit by a snake. And the mountain, the clouds went about 500,000 feet down the mountaintop. It was clear underneath.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to the mountain, I saw the clouds, started into it, and I knew that if I got in trouble, I could fall off into the valley. And I did. I did that several times. Well, I'm praying like crazy, you know, good Lord, why are you doing this? Show me the way. And then the crew is very nervous, and so finally I said, okay, guys. And they're screaming at me, he's going into convulsions, the patient. So I said, you know, we got to give another shot, guys. And I always flew with my window open. I headed into that stuff one more time, straight into it, up, and you know how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was blown sidewards, and that wind was the breath of God, because I looked out my window. I thought we were going in. I was looking for a hole in the trees. And I could see the tip of my rotor blade, and I could see the top of the trees. So I had two reference points. I knew I was right side up. And I turned that H model sideways and hovered up the mountain and in and got those guys. And that's a technique I used the day I got the medal. The fog was at the base of a fire support base, and the guys were on the top of the mountain looking down. And we used the same technique. We would come to a hover at the edge of the clouds, turn it sideways, and head in. You had to do a very careful map recon. But as long as you can see about 20 feet in that stuff. And that's all you need to see, because as long as you can get to the tip of the rotor blades and the ground or a tree or some other reference point, you can keep it right side up and fly sidewards. You can't go very fast,
mm-hmm.
But you can use that technique, and I used it many times. And the day that I used it on the Medal of Honor day, they just happened to be sitting on that mountaintop seeing me come up out of the clouds.
Well, as you said, there were, you know, probably many, many missions that you went on and that your other fellow pilots and crewmen went on, but just nobody observed it, so nobody was able to write it up and get the awards, because even though many of your pilots were awarded Distinguished Flying Crosses and even one Medal of Honor and some other things, probably they deserved more.
Oh, God, yes. They were very highly decorated, and the book, I list the awards for that 40-man detachment. It may have been the most highly awarded 40 men ever in terms of distinguished Silver Stars, Distinguished Flying Crosses, Medal of Honor, Distinguished Service Cross, Air Medals galore, Soldier's Medals, Bronze Stars, but... you can never take care of the guys who to make sure they get what they deserve, because somebody has to see it, mm-hmm. somebody has to care enough, and that's the great thing about the medal, is that somebody saw it and cared enough about what you did and you to go through the effort to document it. And very often, nobody would do that. They were too busy, and so people who did a lot more than I did in my own unit and other places were never recognized as they should have been.
Very, very true. And sometimes, we won't go into that. Some other people got medals that they didn't necessarily deserve.
Yeah, that's true, too.
I want you to, we've got about 5 minutes left, and unfortunately the hour has flown by again as usual. Tell me about what you feel happened as a result of the Vietnam War, the perception is that we lost it. We know from a military standpoint that's furthest from the truth, but from a public relations standpoint, we did.
Yes, we did. The war was lost by the people back here, especially the media. The media was the one who demonized the GI when he came home, and so we kind of all became reclusive. And it wasn't until many years later that I recognized what a great humanitarian effort is it, and that unit I was in, that I decided to write the book. But the poor Vietnam veteran came back. He has become a great citizen of this country. He is also the architect of the great victory in Desert Storm, Desert Shield. He was the guy that did that. He's been leaders in his community. He is a great veteran. And I think America, right now, Your listeners should know that we're beginning a celebration, the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War. We had a great gathering here in San Antonio, Texas, and they're going to be doing this in cities across America for the next, I don't know how many years, as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the war in Vietnam. So I think America is ashamed of the way that they treated the Vietnam veteran, and I think that accounts for the way we treat the guy today, who is treated with great reverence, and our soldiers today deserve that. But a lot of it had to do with the way, I don't think it was so much the American people as it was the American media and certain politicians. So I've had politicians turn their back to keep from having a picture taken with me when they found out I was a Vietnam veteran. So
Are you serious?
Absolutely true. And it was just horrible the way the stories you hear. And the suicide rate of the guy coming back from Vietnam in the first couple of years was high, but then it was lower than his cohort in civilian life. Today it's out of sight. I mean, they really are abusing these kids today in terms of deployments. The combat is not nearly as intense as it was in Vietnam, but the stresses are much higher. Separations from family, 6 out of 10 years deployed. Mm-hmm. They don't have a force structure that can handle the mission, and so they abuse these kids. It's horrible the way they're treating them, and the suicide rates are out of sight, and so are the PTSD rates.
Absolutely, and I certainly can understand that just with the apprehension and so forth that we went through while we were there, and then you come home and people really didn't care. And I don't want it to sound like whining to people. It's just that you just want to be acknowledged for serving your country, because we did that.
That's exactly right.
Even if you were drafted, you stepped up. You didn't run away, and you did your job. And we can all get off on a big tangent on that. I want to talk a little bit about aircraft in our last 2 minutes. They've gone to the Apache and the other, I forget what it's called,
Blackhawk.
The Blackhawk now, and the Huey has been retired, which is sad.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
In your book, you talk about that the Blackhawk cannot do the same thing that a Huey did.
No, the Black Hawk was designed for the aviation mentality, airfield to airfield, cargo, troops. It was not designed to work the jungles and combat areas. Now, the desert's a different kind of an area, but the Black Hawk, I've got very little time in it, very little time in the Apache, but the Black Hawk has a tail-low attitude. It's not quick. It's powerful, and it'll handle a crash a little better than the Huey, but nothing was ever, and we, those of us, when they were designing the Black Hawk for dust-off, tried to tell them, just put another engine on the Huey, put in a radar altimeter, and keep it. And we used to always say that the Huey would fly the funeral procession for the Black Hawk, but they finally retired it. And by the way, the Huey is the most combat experienced aircraft in history. 16 million sorties. I don't know how they measured those things, but over 7 million combat hours in the Huey. No other aircraft in history, World War One, Two, ever, has had. And it's amazing to me that some museums don't display the Huey, although we did manage to get one up in the Museum of Flight up in Seattle, and it's getting a lot of attention up there. But it is the most combat experienced aircraft in history, and what it did and what the pilots did, the helicopter pilots in Vietnam developed skills that were unique on the battlefields of history. And unfortunately, because they demonized that war and those warriors, that helicopter pilot never got the recognition I think he deserved.
Well, we got to stop it on that. Thank you for your comments. We've been talking with Major General Patrick Brady, author of Dead Men Flying. Don't miss it. Go out and get this book. Thank you very much, General, for being on Veterans Radio today.
It's a pleasure being with another helicopter pilot, always.
Thank you, sir. Until next week, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.